suffer through it. You'll appreciate kites, my more. All right, so we're going to Bezrat Hashem. We're in Perak Gimel, Halacha Gimel, I think. And we're going to Chapter 3, Halacha 3 of Hilchot Deot. And we're going to finish, we're going to conclude the third chapter of Hilchot Deot. So yesterday we said that even when a person is asleep, here, help yourself. There you go. Okay. Said yesterday that even when a person is asleep, right? Afilu b'shashu hu yashen. We're in the middle of page 61 if you're in the English, and in the Hebrew, we're in Perek Gimel Halacha Gimel, and we are just about to answer a question that we had. It's three lines from the bottom of the halacha. Okay. Afilu b'shashu yashen, we said, even when a person's asleep. If a person's sleeping in order that he can rest, right? And that he won't be sick. Because he can't serve Hashem when he's sick. So that means that his sleep is a form of avodah. It's a form of service. So the question I asked yesterday, we ended off with, is why here is the name Makom? Why is it that sleep then is a service of that a person sort of is involved in lamakom baruchu, right? To Hashem the makom. Why don't you say shash to Hashem leilokav? Why do you say makom? So first of all, if you want to understand pshat in makom, where else do you find makom? Where else is God called the makom? Two famous places. Baruch hamakom baruchu. When is Hashem called baruch hamakom baruchu? Pardon? It's in the Haggadah, but that doesn't mean it's the time. How does it finish? Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu. Oh, Hashem was the Makom when He gave us Torah. That's a little strange. It's true the Torah was given in a place, but the place that the Torah was given in was the place that isn't the place. Like the desert, by definition, is that place that's no place. That was the whole point of giving the desert the Torah. What? Pardon? Oh, that was the whole point of giving the Torah in the desert, that you wouldn't think it has to do with the place. So why is Hashem called the Makom there? Where else do you find the concept of Makom? Famous. Obvious. HaMakom Yenachem Etchem B'toch She'ev Eretz Yerushalayim. Right? When someone's in mourning, just before you walk out of the Shiva, you're supposed to walk over to the person, you're supposed to wait till he finishes whatever conversation he's having. Most mourners are sensitive, so they kind of stop in the middle and realize that you have to do your thing. And then you say, "Makom menachem etchem b'toch she'ev leitzion Yerushalayim." In Israel, we add "v'lo tosif lo davaod," and you should know no more. There should be no more grief added. Whatever, right? By the way, interesting question. We say "Makom menachem etchem," plural. What do you say to a mourner if he's the only mourner sitting? You still say "Makom menachem etchem." Why? Plural. Nope, that's not true. He is. He's the only guy sitting Shiva. Pardon? Let's say guy's an only son. His mother passed away a long time ago. Pardon?
We're all mourning for the return of Zion.
Nope. That's a good, like, throw it out there. The Zion thing will get away. Nope. So one opinion is beautiful, which kind of answers this question, is because the whole idea of Hashem as being the Makom is that when a person mourns alone, he's not mourning alone. HaMakom Yenachem Etchem, which really means that the place should be a comfort to you. It doesn't say, I should be a comfort to you. It doesn't say, you should be comforted. It says, may the place that you're in, the space that you're in, be a comfort to you. Why? Because,
Hashem?
Right. So how does that help comfort a person? Because if you know that you're not sort of before Hashem, but you're in Hashem, if you understand that everything comes from Hashem, that's the essence of Nechama. The essence of Nechama is that you're already in Hashem. That Hashem is reality, and you're in reality. And the closest word that fits that idea is that Hashem is the Makom. Hashem is not just about what you think. Hashem is about where you are. Right? So maybe that's why, and by the way, that's exactly what Torah is. The study of Torah is the ability to change where you are, which of course changes who you are. Like if you have a relationship with Torah, It doesn't matter where you are. You know, they tell a story of the Stipler. The Stipler of Sokanyevsky was one of the great, great Torah giants of the last generation. So he was drafted into the Russian army around his bar mitzvah time. And he had to do, until they finally got him out, you know, he was in the army for like 10 years in Siberia and all sorts of things. I think eventually he got frostbite and this whole story how he got out of the Russian army. But, you know, most people went to the Russian army, they didn't end up, they barely stayed Jewish, let alone religious. And he became one of the Gedolei Ador. So the stories about when he was a young man in the Russian army are legendary, how he would learn, you know, Gemara, Baal Peh, whatever. And he was once doing guard duty on Shabbos. They forced him to do guard duty on Shabbos. And they were able to, they were out in Shetach somewhere in the freezing cold. And then they, you know, would do guard duty during the day in whatever position they were in. And it was freezing cold, the Russian winter. So at night, they would take off their coats and they would hang them on a tree branch over the fire so that they would warm up, you know. And then when they get up in the morning, get out of their sleeping bags, they'd put their coat on, right? So one of the other soldiers was doing him a favor and it was Shabbos. And so he went to sleep, you know, and they were guy amused with like non-Jews and they made a fire and whatever. And they're sleeping, whatever. And he's like learning by the firelight and finally falls asleep. So one of the soldiers put his coat up on the branch, right, to hang it up over the fire. So that's a halachic problem. It's a halachic problem to hang a coat on a branch. And it's a halachic problem to take a coat off a branch. It happens to be that in this particular situation, he could clearly take the coat off the branch because it's in the middle of winter in Russia. And it's dangerous, whatever. But, you know, I guess you become a gadol hador by going way beyond the normal human being's box. And so he did guard duty without his coat on that day, right? As a result of which he got tremendous frostbite, right? So his comrades thought that he was out of his mind, but he said it was Shabbos, right? He wasn't willing to put his coat on and take it off a tree branch because, you know, whatever. The result of that experience was that he got frostbite. Because he got frostbite, he was eventually moved back from the front lines and eventually was released from the army. And when he was asked years later what gave him the strength to do that, right? He said, you know, the Pasuk says, Dalif ne miyata omeid, that you're supposed to know before whom you stand. Right? We most Aron Kodeshes have it somewhere, right? We'll get it up there eventually, right? But, like, if you really could understand that you stand before Hashem, he says, but Dalif ne miyata omeid is the first level. The real level is to understand that you're not standing before Hashem. That Hashem is everywhere. Hashem is, you're in Hashem. So why does the Rambam say, Nitzet sheina shelo avodala makom baruchu? Right? Because if all of reality is an extension of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, we were just talking about the fact that everything you do L'Shem Shamayim, right? So then obviously it goes without saying that Sheina, that you don't leave the reality of Hashem just because you go to sleep. You change your relationship with the reality that you're in. But you're in the same reality. In fact, on a certain level, when you go to sleep and you sort of distance yourself, remove yourself to some degree from the reality, the physical reality, right, so there's this whole mystical idea that you become more connected to your neshama. You're a less physical being when you sleep, right? Because the physical part of you becomes dormant, and the consciousness, the neshama, becomes more what's the opposite of dormant? Active? I don't know. Right? Where you have dreams, and therefore you're more connected. That's why we say lokai neshama sheni shenatata bi. Right? You say in the morning the neshama that you gave me, because you're more in touch with the fact that you're really a neshama. So that's where the Rambam says that you understand that your sleep is service to the makom. And that brings us to the end of the halacha. It says, Va'al inyan zeh tzivu chachamim v'amru, v'chol masecha yu l'shem shamayim, v'hu shamar shlomo v'chachmoto v'chol drachecha deyu, v'hu yasher orchotecha. So now there's two quotes here. The first is, v'chol masecha yu l'shem shamayim. Okay? And all of your actions should be L'Shem Shamayim. Anybody recognize this quote? No? Okay, this is from Pirkei Avos. The second quote is from Mishnah. The second quote is a Pasuk. Which should come first?
The second quote
is V'chol drachecha deyu v'hu yasher orchotecha. Right? Which is Shlomo Melech, right? So first you should say a Pasuk, and then you say, on this Pasuk, Chazal say, the rabbis say, V'chol masecha yu L'Shem Shamayim. So the Rambam switches around the order. Why does the Rambam switch around the order? Doesn't make sense. Anyone want to take a guess? Look at these two psukim and see if you can figure out why they would be in this order. What's the difference? Why does the Rambam have to bring them both? Obviously, if b'chol drachecha de'eu, if you relate to Hashem in all of your paths, so then all of your ma'asim should be l'shem shamayim. Why do you need both? What's the difference between them?
I think they each lead into the other. Like what you said, obviously, about drachecha leading into b'sefa. But if your actions are all pointed towards heaven, or towards shamayim, or towards Hashem, whatever you want to say, then you'll start to, quote unquote, realize things about what you're doing that you hadn't seen before that make them seem much more holy. You know, like I never realized that if Gus hadn't come on time, I would have made it to the Beis Midrash.
But what's the difference? You're talking about how they connect, but what are they? What's the difference between V'chol Masecha?
Actions and intentions?
Well, that's interesting. What is b'chol drachecha de'eu, in all of your paths, let's say? No, Hashem, that means in everything you do it in order to develop a relationship with Hashem. That's what he's been saying.
An isolated thing versus like a series. Like the drachecha could be like your goals. It could be like a whole plan or a whole series of actions as opposed to a singular term.
I don't know. There's got to be something sharper than that. Is it amazing? Anybody? No? The difference between b'chol drachecha de'eu and v'chol masecha yu l'shem shamayim? So the Likutei Sichos says an interesting thing. And it reminds me, there's a Gemara that says, Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe was a fellow by the name of Nachum Ish Gamzu. You must have heard of that name. He was called Nachum Ish Gamzu because he always used to say, anybody know?
Gamzu
L'tava. Right? So that's what he said. This too is for the good. Didn't matter what happened to him. Somebody walks over, he spits in your face. Ah, Baruch Hashem, this must be good. Okay. So Rabbi Akiva was his Talmud, right? So what did Rabbi Akiva used to say? Rabbi Akiva used to say, "Kol man to avid rachmana latava avid." Whatever Hashem does for the good, right? So the question is, what's the difference? Why didn't he just say gamzu l'tova? How come his Rebbe of Nachum said gamzu l'tova? This is for the good, and he used to say, "Kol man to avid rachmana latava avid." Whatever Hashem does for the best. Why does he feels the need to elaborate? Is there a difference between these two ideas? So one of the commentaries suggests, as great as Rabbi Akiva was trying to demonstrate, or maybe it was just apparent in what they said, that he still wasn't his Rebbe. Like, if you think about it, this is the difference between the world of science and the world of religion. Because in Judaism, in the Torah world, the further away you get from the source, the more progressive society gets, the lower level. Like, we're not on the level of those that came before us, right? You would never imagine Rav Aaron Lichtenstein saying, comparing himself to the Chafetz Chaim, and you would never imagine the Chafetz Chaim comparing himself to the Vilna Gaon, and you would never imagine the Vilna Gaon comparing himself to the Rambam. The further along we get, the further away from the source we get, the lower the level. On the other hand, in the world of science, so people look at science and say, okay, Newton was great, but he obviously wasn't as great as Einstein, because Einstein took all the knowledge of Newton, and he built on it, so he obviously was on a much greater level. And Hawking is an even greater level than Einstein because he built on Einstein's theory and he knows things and come up with things that scientific theory has discovered that Einstein didn't even dream of, right? Because in the world of science, the source is human beings. So therefore, the more developed we are, the greater we are. And in Judaism, the source is not us. We're just the vehicle. The source is Hashem. So Rabbi Akiva is basically saying that he's not on the level of his Rebbe. Rabbi Akiva was saying that everything Hashem does for the good. I can't see that the action is good, but I know that if it comes from Hashem, there's good to it. There must be a good purpose to it, even though I don't get that the action is good. But Nachum Ish Gamzu was saying, it's not that this action I don't understand, this is a bad action, but there must be a good purpose to it. The action itself is good. In other words, Rabbi Akiva would look, chas v'shalom, at a tremendous disaster like the Haiti earthquake, and he would say, even though we don't understand this terrible calamity, since Hashem runs the world, good will come of it. Rav Nachum Ish Gamzu Kaviyachol, though I don't think he would say this to the people suffering in Haiti, would say, no, the essence of the earthquake is good, just we don't see it. But those are two different levels. And that's one way of understanding these two lines. Right? V'chol ma'asecha yu l'shem shamayim says, my actions might not be pure, but at least I want them to be for the right reason. You understand? But b'chol drachecha de'ehu, in other words, it's not that my action is the will of Hashem, it's that I'm trying to do my action with Hashem in mind. The action isn't the will of Hashem, but I'm trying to do my action with Hashem in mind. But b'chol drachecha de'ehu means that, in fact, the action itself is an extension of Hashem. That's a much higher level. And I wonder if maybe the Rambam is implying that when you When you can access the one, you can begin to get to the level of the second. So I don't know if we're meant to get to the level of Shlomo Melech, B'chol Drachecha Deyehu, but we're definitely able to get to the level of V'chol Ma'asecha L'Hashem Shamayim. Right? And in fact, there's a famous Gemara. The Gemara says in Beitza, in Daf Tet Zayin, talking about the difference between Hillel and Shammai. And one of the differences it says, "Aval Hillel Azakin Mida Acheret Haytalo Shechol Masav L'Hashem Shamayim." He had a different Mida because what epitomized Hillel, who was basically the pillar of Torah Shabbat Peh, was that all of his actions were L'Hashem Shamayim. And they give an example in the Medrash. I couldn't find it before, but it's in Vayikra Rabba somewhere. The Medrash basically says that that Hillel was seen running one morning. He was running somewhere. So they asked him where he's running to. So he says he's running to the bathhouses. So he says, "You're running to the bathhouses." That'd be the equivalent of like seeing Rav Moshe Feinstein running to a basketball game. Like not necessarily usher, but just you wouldn't expect Hillel Azakin to run to the bathhouse. The bathhouse was where people spoke Lashon Hara, was there, you know. People, you know, bathed in the noon. I mean, it just wasn't a place for Talmud Chacham. So, pardon? Yeah, but they didn't go to the bathhouses to go to mikvah. They went to a mikvah to go to mikvah. Or they went to a mayan, a wellspring. The bathhouse was the place that you schwitzed and you sweated and you adorned yourself and you know, they didn't have like showers in the house. So if you wanted to make yourself look nice and, you know, feel refreshed and put on the perfumes and all that stuff, this was part of Roman society. And before that, Greek society, the Greeks worshipped the body. And so they had whole industries that were based on pampering your body and getting your body into good health, etc. So it'd be like, you know, like, you might find, like, let's say, a Rebbe from this yeshiva or any other going for a run. But you wouldn't find, like, if you sort of know him and he was, you know, he'd entered himself in a bodybuilding competition. So I'm not sure a bodybuilding competition is usher, but you would just, pardon? It'd be so cute, right? You just look at that like this. There's something off with that. Like, you know, just what a Talmud Chacham should be one of these guys going like this, you know? Like, this isn't, right? So they asked Hillel this question, right? So Hillel basically said, Hashem gave me this body, right? And I have to beautify this body because b'chol drachecha dayu. You have to make your body healthy because making your body healthy is one way to serve Hashem. That was a radical idea that the Gemara quotes this because it was so out of the box, right? And you can look around you in the Jewish world and see that there are people who get this and people who don't. And it's a dangerous line because, you know, you can take it to an extreme and it can be off.
Yeah, so like anytime you're like on a bus through Ben Sharm and there's like a guy who you can tell maybe has not showered in a long time or maybe he's like a and they're kind of breaking a mitzvah to keep your body clean.
So now we're going to get into the realm of opinion. I'm not saying that this is psak halacha, because I don't want to be a posek certainly on tap, but if you want my opinion on the matter, and I want to be clear that there's a difference, to me, that's exactly what the Ramban is talking about in Parashat Kedoshim.
Right. Yeah, it's like a prohibition against things. Like, it doesn't say anywhere, don't drink so much wine that you're falling off your seat every night. But like Kedoshim to you, don't overeat.
The Ramban says, how do you define Kedoshim to you? Al tiyeh naval b'rshut haTorah. You sit next, don't be a pig. With the permission of Torah. In other words, if you're sitting down on an LL plane and some guy in a kapota and a beard sits down next to you and they bring him his food and he's like, you know, he's hungry. So instead of like taking it and eating it, he takes all the food and he rips open the packages and he puts it all on the tray. He gets everything out of the way and then he folds the tray, right? And then he holds it up and goes, and he just shovels it in, right? And it's like pouring down his cheek and it's all over the place. And you're sitting next to me, good boy, this is going to be a long flight. Is he over an Isser? The Ramban would say, and there are different ways of interpreting whether the Ramban is saying that it's actually an Isser or the Ramban is saying the whole point is that it's not an Isser. It's precisely because there's no clear and specific prohibition against it that there needs to be a pasuk. Don't be a pig. Like sometimes you don't have to define it as Isser. You should just know that you don't behave that way. Right? He being the Rambam.
The Rambam.
Oh, well, the Rambam has a bit of a different take on some of these things, but yeah.
I don't know, one of them said, like, it's not just, like, overeating, it's, like, overdoing anything that, like, Hashem permits you. Hashem allows you to drink, don't get drunk. Hashem allows you to sleep, don't sleep for 14 hours.
That's right. By the way, that's a great example, because that's exactly what the Rambam is talking about here. Like, you're allowed to have a cup of wine now and again, and you're allowed to have a, you know, a shot, you know, you're sitting in Shabbos. Like, I personally have a policy, because I've just seen the students. It is incredibly easy for a person to become an alcoholic. There are alcoholics in the Frum community. There are people who started out just going to Kiddush, you know, and then it became a Kiddush club, and then it became a bottle club, you know, finish the bottle. We were in Florida, and we got a knock on our door. We were in the middle of Shabbos lunch, and a woman, one of the neighbors, came over distraught because her husband had come home, and they had had some Kiddush club, whatever it is, and he really drank a lot. And he staggered home, and he collapsed in front of the house, and they couldn't get him inside, right? And, you know, she was with little kids. She didn't know what to do. So she came next door. So I happened to have a couple guests, and we came in, and we brought him inside, and we took him on the sofa. And I went over there on Sunday afternoon. I wanted to talk to him. I said, look, you know, that's a pretty extreme situation that your wife has to go to a neighbor. How embarrassing. Like, what an opportunity to realize, like, you've gotten extreme. You should not be drinking Kiddush and Kiddush clubs. And I said to him, look, I'm not an expert on the matter, but if you can't go this Shabbos without having any schnapps, then you have an addiction issue, and you're an alcoholic. And you may not realize you're an alcoholic. And he's like, talking about, I'm not an alcoholic, I just had too much to drink. Like, people don't realize, like, there isn't, like, you don't get a message from the, you know, the tobacco and alcohol directorate, you know, you are officially now an alcoholic. People become alcoholics who know they shouldn't become alcoholics, because they start, and moderation leads to extreme. So how do you know you've reached an extreme? Well, if you can have a drink and you're tipsy and you didn't intend to be tipsy, that's an extreme.
Suppose if you're passed out in front of your house.
Pardon? Yeah, you know, it's funny, but you know what? Go to town here any night. Go to town here certainly on a Thursday night. And never mind the general population. Just look at American yeshiva kids who are here for the year. And there are definitely kids who go out and they go to a bar and they get drunk. And they are at risk of being alcoholics. They just don't realize it. Well, I'm not even talking about how it makes us feel. I'm just saying, like, there's a sakana there. Like, that's a real danger. I mean, we had an issue with that, you know, in this yeshiva. It's a serious thing. It's not just a serious thing because of how it affects the yeshiva and how it affects whatever. It's a serious thing because this person is at risk. You know, if it's that easy to do it here, what happens when you're in 4 years of college? And, you know, if you do that for 4 years of college, an addiction is an addiction. It's a substance that causes you to become addicted to it. You can't just turn it off at the end of 4 years of college. That's where alcoholism starts. There are statistics that suggest that the number of people who become alcoholics in college is huge. There are differing statistics depending on how you define it. That's an unbelievable. So let's say you realize why. So that's the Rambam. The Rambam says, okay, you reach an extreme. Go to the other extreme. You got to teetotal yourself. Like, I'm capable of having a schnapps on Shabbos. By the way, I got a piece of advice from somebody once, and I have stuck to this for probably 20 years. I never drink alone, ever. Never drink alone. I'll sit at my Shabbos table. Unless I have a guest who wants to have a schnapps, I will never have a schnapps on my own at the Shabbos table. I've never, ever drank alone. I hope I never do. I never come home at the end of the day and have a glass of wine. I've met people who became alcoholics because they started with a cup of wine at the end of a day, and then after a year it becomes two cups of wine, and before you know it, they're sitting down in their chair, and they're, you know, sort of inebriated in front of the television. And that's just one step away from being an alcoholic. So one way to make sure that doesn't happen, never drink alone. Never drink alone. But that's an extreme if you think about it to a certain degree. It's an extreme thing to say you would never do something alone. The reason you go to that extreme is because of the extreme that you're trying to avoid. It's worth avoiding that extreme.
No, it's, I mean, it's something that I have a friend who, she drank, like, occasionally or something, like, at parties maybe once in a while, and she eventually got to the point where she had, like, a bottle of vodka sitting in her closet, like, at all times.
Very dangerous. By the way, one of the questions that a person has when you find yourself, or, you know, maybe it's not you, maybe you're in college and you have a roommate, usually a person gets into that state because the extreme begins on the inside. In other words, a person who feels a need to drink, you know, especially somewhat regularly, it's because there's an emptiness that's inside that they're trying to escape from. And one way to escape from that is to escape to a different level of consciousness, which is whether it's drinking or drugs or all sorts of other things. So when a person feels that, when you can tap into the fact that that's why you're taking that escape route, then you really have to find a way, because that's what we very often do. We deal with symptoms. You know, like I told you, I once sponsored someone and went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. It was an education.
What does that mean, you sponsored them?
in order for someone to join Alcoholics Anonymous, they have to have a sponsor. And a sponsor means that you commit that you're going to be there for this person no matter what, because you're determined to help them break this. That means that they can call you at 3 o'clock in the morning, they call you on Shabbos. For this particular, I had a student who was really on the edge, and I was trying to get him to go to AA, and so he said he would only go if I took him to a meeting. So there's like certain meetings where you can go if you're not the alcoholic. Once a month, once every 2 months, whatever, I don't remember. So I took him to the meeting, right? I was just expecting I would take him and he would see it and then he would decide to do it. So in the end, they spoke to me and they said, look, if you want this person to succeed, you know, are you prepared to help him? Are you willing to sponsor him? And they're very clever. They do it in such a way that you really, how could you say no? Like they say, the life of this person's in your hands. You just don't realize it. Like, well.
That's a good way to do that.
Right. And they were right. So I agreed to do this. It was a very difficult thing to do, and I had some very strange experiences. And I actually got psak halacha that if this person called me on Shabbos, I could pick up the phone, I could drive to them, because mamash is sakanas nefashos. It's a person's life is in danger. A person's life could be destroyed. So that's what you have to do. They have to go, and they have to, you know, regularly see this. But one of the things, and you're not allowed to go to all the meetings. Like most of the meetings, you don't go to. But once every so often, you have to go, and one time this person called me because they get like a card and the card has your name and your number or whatever, and it's like whatever. And some places have like necklaces that they put on the person, so if he walks into a bar, someone will recognize the necklace and someone else will look at it and see the phone number and call. So I got a call once. This person was sitting in a bar and he was sitting in front of a beer and he was struggling with whether he was going to drink the beer, right? And you're supposed to say to him, at least don't drink it till I get there, and et cetera, right? Can you stop a person? Because that's all it takes is one beer if a person's an alcoholic, and he's right back on the wagon, right? It's a very serious thing, right? So one of the things that you see there is that what they're trying to get to, like there's this, I forget what it is, a 10-step program, 12-step program, right? But basically what they're doing is, in order to remove the external, in order to get you out of that world of alcohol, what you're doing is you're creating a vacuum. It's a very dangerous thing to do. Here's a guy who's essentially unhappy or in pain or confused. And it doesn't have to be extreme. It doesn't have to be that he's standing on a window ledge and trying to kill himself. He's just in a certain amount of pain. He's lonely, maybe he's social challenges, whatever. And then he sees that when he drinks a little, so he feels a little happier, so he feels better. Because you feel happy. You know, you don't know that you're the class idiot when you're drinking. You think everybody's laughing with you. And that becomes comfortable because you're used to being lonely. So you drink some more and all sorts of things like that. It doesn't have to be an extreme. So now you pull this person away from alcohol. All of a sudden you've reintroduced into his life this pain. So if you don't find a way to help him deal with that pain, you've created a vacuum. It's just going to fill out. You're not going to do anything. And that's why people have to connect to a higher power, which is either Kodesh Baruch or whatever it might be, right? So it's the same thing. If you can be in the reality of Hashem, then you're never alone. It's this is a recipe for life. I challenge you to find any issue that we deal with in this world that this isn't the ultimate solution. Challenge you. Now, this doesn't prove anything. Maybe we made up God in order to solve these problems. But if a person has Hashem in their life, this at least makes it extremely worthwhile to put the work in to see if you can find Hashem in your life, because it changes your life. Totally changes your life.
And if...
Well, that's like being married and not being in love. Like, you could be married and decide that there's something so valuable to actually being in love that you're willing to work to see if you can turn that relationship into a relationship of love. But until you get there, you're not there. Right? And when you're there, you know you're there. And even when you're there, it doesn't mean you stop working. It's a constant work. It takes a tremendous amount of work for a relationship. Relationships are never standing still. They're either growing or they're declining. Right?
Degenerating,
moving backwards or forwards, right? So it's true with the relationships with people in your life, whether it be friends or marriage or children, whatever it may be, right? You know, when I go away, when I do a lot of traveling, like this recruitment season, so I see the impact on my kids. I have to put a lot of work in because I built a very close relationship with my kids and I don't want that to change, but it takes a lot of work. And same is true with your wife. Same is true with your students. I mean, you may not notice it, but I certainly do. Like, you want to be in a certain place when you're sitting with people in the basement. And when I keep going away, it makes it very difficult. So that takes a lot more work, as much work as you can do, and it's balanced. It's doubly true when it comes to your relationship with Hashem. A relationship with Hashem stagnates or becomes almost non-existent. Oh, that's like some bar mitzvah, right? Okay? They didn't have the shofar, so they're using kazoos, whatever, right? right? Bad day, right? Nebuch. But right? So b'chol drachecha dayu, right? If you can see Hashem, if you can know Hashem, if you can use every different avenue to develop a relationship with Hashem. By the way, I'll tell you one more thing. One of the challenges that I find people have is that you kind of intellectually can get your hands around the idea that it makes sense that Hashem created the world. And you can even intellectually get your hands around the idea that it's worth developing a relationship with Hashem. I think where people fall short is they don't know how to connect that to this Jewish idea of mitzvot. Like, how does that connect to the fact that I wear tefillin? How does that connect to wearing tzitzit? How does that connect to kashrut and all these different things? Because all those different pieces are basically mini workshops in developing your relationship with Hashem. It's like every Friday is a ritual. Friday night is a ritual in your relationship with your family. Just is. Okay? The space that I'm in my relationship with my family at the beginning of Shabbat and at the end of Shabbat is a totally different space. We're in a totally different space. I sat up last week, so my aunt got out of the army. And I hadn't had a chance to talk to her. I was in America, whatever, the previous Shabbat. So, you know, we finished dinner and whatever. One of the kids went to Bnei Akiva and whatever else they were doing, I don't remember. And I was sitting up with my aunt, and we sat up till 12:30 at night, 1 in the morning, just schmoozing. You know, just talking. And it's amazing when you have a kid, like, who's your age, because, like, you're adults now. You can really talk on a different level than when they're little kids. So we had this great, great discussion. And I was thinking about it afterwards, like, I don't know how people manage without Shabbat. What allows me to have that discussion? Like, I'm addicted to the laptop. I am. I'm addicted to email and BlackBerry. So I have to make a conscious decision. Like, it's not sitting on my belt, and I don't always remember. It doesn't come, like, I try not to. I'm sitting here now. I don't have my phone. I don't have my BlackBerry. I don't have any of that stuff. So I'm in the moment, and we're learning. But as soon as I get up, I'll go back because I things I have to do. But on Shabbat, it's nowhere to be found. I have no urge to go check email because I can't because it's Shabbos. So that creates that vacuum, that window, which I fill with the relationship, right? And all these rituals, the same thing happens to me in the morning. You know, it's. I don't know about you guys, but for me, you know, and you'll see when you work and you have all these projects and things are going on. So morning is a valuable time when everything's still quiet. You can get a head start on the day. And then you stop and you go to shul and you daven. And you're putting on the tefillin, and you take a moment to appreciate that, and you just push everything aside, and you have a chance to think about what you want this day to be, and what you want your relationship with Hashem to be, and how you want it to grow. It's a ritual that allows you, it's an action. By the way, I'm not talking about the whole mystical side. Like, there's a whole mystical side to this, which is, you know, when you're putting on a pair of tefillin, there's something mystical going on that we don't begin to understand. That's a whole other discussion, right? And that's also about b'chol drachecha da'eyu, in every place that you look, right? And that's basically what the Likut Yisicho says. So we'll finish here. This is basically the end of Perek Gimel. There's a lot more to talk about on this topic. But if I had to summarize the third chapter of the Rambam is that point where he takes you from the stage of we need to recognize the extremes and find a way to the middle. Sometimes that means going to one extreme in order to get back to the middle. Sometimes it means the ability to be in the middle. And now the Rambam says that the way to do that is b'chol drachecha de'eyu, b'chol masecha yu l'shem shamayim, that you can take everything in your life and give it that purpose and ask yourself that question, and that reduces all of those negative traits in your life. Now we're going to get to Perek Daled, which, like I said, we're going to spend maybe a day or two on, even though it's a long Perek, because it's basically the Rambam's regimen for how to live a healthy life. And if you're into that sort of thing, I think it's valuable, and we'll talk about why the Rambam includes this here or whatever, Bezrat Hashem. Well, actually, not tomorrow, because